There are many kinds of museums, from the hallowed halls of the Louvre to the humble home of Jesse James, from Tulsa to Tokyo to the Tate Modern. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Today we're talking with two of the art world's most important thought leaders, Parag Vartanian, co-founder and editor of the popular and influential website Hyperallergic, and Sharon Loudon, artist, educator, advocate, and editor of a series of books on how to live, and more importantly, how to sustain a creative life. We talk about all sorts of things, but mostly about museums, what they're doing right, what they're doing wrong, and how to know the difference. What were your relationships, and you can jump in anytime you want, as far as early relationships to museums? Do you have any early memories of first couple times you ever went to a museum or the earliest memory of a museum? What was that? Where was it?
In Washington, D.C. in 1984, when I came back from college, because I was raised in the Washington, D.C. area in Olney, Maryland. And when I was in high school, I went to public high school, and my art teacher would always take us as a class to the Hirshhorn, to the National Gallery of Art. They were all free. So we got in a habit, which was really wonderful, to go to these museums. So I would then go on my own after high school. And I'll never forget seeing this exhibition called Content at the Hirshhorn. And it changed my entire life. It made me a professional artist today. That was the decider, was that exhibition. I saw works that really changed my life, like Mario Mertz, his Eskimo tents, if you will, and just Cindy Sherman, Robert Longo, like of the time in the 1980s.
Were you being exposed to these artists for the first time at that show, or did you have any kind of knowledge of their work at all leading up to seeing that for the first time?
I would just say not much. I mean, I saw this massive Chris Burden installation with matches on nickels, and it gave me for the first time the idea that an artist can have a voice in multiple forms. And then it also showed me how an artist can be political in different ways. And it just changed my entire life.
So you're spending all this time going to the museum by yourself and using that time to explore and start building up kind of your own self-education. Was this something that your peers were doing at the time? Was this something that you'd say on a Friday night or whenever you're going to the museum, like, I'm going to go hang out at the museum? Or was that something that you looked forward to doing solo, or you weren't trying to take friends or have that be more of a social time?
No, I did it on my own. I was a loner for a long time, and I really enjoyed that time away from everybody and experiencing that exhibition. I think one of the reasons why it changed me so much was I was able to absorb it in that quiet space, and I still have the catalog. It's out of print, and I was able to follow all of those artists, too, from that point forward and see how they evolved. But I felt like for the first time as an artist, I was included. And so since then, museums for me have been about an inclusivity for artists and also for community and community engagement.
Parag, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Toronto.
You grew up in Toronto. That's okay. Right. And so did you have a relationship early on with museums? Was it something that your family did for recreation, for fun, go hang out at the
Not
museum?
Not really, actually. You know, it's like I think for us, culture was very lived. We'd be going to like plays, and it would be within our own sort of communities and stuff. And when I say that, I grew up in an Armenian community in Toronto, and my family was much more comfortable in that kind of milieu. But then around the age of around 12, 13 is, I think, around the time where I started discovering what museums were, you know, and I think I probably went to museums beforehand. And I had a very special experience as a kid in that in grade school, one of my art teachers was blind. And so I actually learned art. My favorite art teacher actually as a kid was a blind man who, when he was in late 20s, became blind. And he would teach us about art not just being visual. And it was like, it kind of blew my mind. And that was the age where I started going to museums. But it wasn't just in Toronto. Like, I went actually, I spent, believe it or not, I went to a Soviet day camp in Soviet Armenia when I was 12. And, you know, and then I'd go visit, because I was born in Aleppo, Syria, go to museums there. And then in Toronto, I'd go to the Royal Ontario Museum and the Art Gallery of Ontario. And I just realized somehow that museums were a thing and they were really fascinating places.
Was it the scope and scale of the place? Was it the...
Yeah, it blew my mind. Yeah. I mean, when you saw things that were thousands of years old, but you also saw things that looked really like, how did they do that? But then there were other things where it's like, you're like, why is this here? You know, there was like, I mean, for a young inquisitive mind, all of a sudden I was like, there are a lot of questions here.
I think, you know, we get to the place where a lot of people need their entry points to museums. And I think we get to a place a lot of times where if someone comes to a museum and sees something that's very old, say something from the Italian Renaissance or older, and sometimes the first thing they're interested in is the fact that it's just an old piece, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, that's not the most interesting thing about it. But when you're young and you're looking at things, those are the same things probably that get us excited. It's something that's like, wow, it's time travel in a certain kind of way. And maybe it's not that. Maybe it's the subject matter. But there's these different ways to kind of get engaged with it. As, you know, critics and artists, do you have any preferred entry point to work? Do you think like, where however someone gets to the work is the best way they could have gotten to it, you know, as far as different avenues into it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that really is key, because I think everyone brings their own history and their own experience and everything to the work. And I love when people tell me like, oh, I got to this work because, you know, I mean, it could be ridiculous. Something like, I saw it on a TV show that had nothing to do with that work or something. Or, you know, it was in a book I read. And you're like, great. You know, if that sparked your interest, then that's fantastic. That's why, as much as I can complain about celebrities getting into contemporary art and all stuff, you know what? They're an entry point for some people who may not otherwise have discovered that piece. And I think that's fantastic.
Well, Sharon, I wonder, on the side of kind of curation, when you talk to museum curators and you see what the public likes, take any museum and you say, here are the 10 most popular fan favorite pieces, the most popular things in the collection that are on view, maybe long-standing pieces. And then you were to ask the curatorial staff at that museum what the most valuable, not valuable in terms of cost, but the kind of most important pieces in the museum are. I think you're going to see a big, huge discrepancy between those two things a lot of the times. Talk about the relationship kind of between the professionals, if someone's curating a show, and the audience in terms of giving people what they want versus presenting what you think they need to be seeing.
As an artist, of course, I really think it's important to think about the audience, but to serve the audience by giving a vision to and not serve them necessarily things that they may think they need or want. So I think old shows that we've seen over and over and over again don't need to be shown anymore. I think I actually have a problem with museums showing the same people over and over again in many different places and not taking so much of a risk with the 99% of artists who are out there who could really benefit too from that visibility and that opportunity to exchange with the public, but also the public too, to see that there are many things out there other than things that have been shown over many years. I mean, I'm just thinking about the old classic artists like Vincent van Gogh, who died in 1890. I mean, It's just over. I would like to see other things beyond what has been seen. But I'm not a museum curator, but I work with a lot of them. And what I enjoy the most about them is they're open to collaboration with artists. And the best relationships I have with curators is this elastic give and take. It's not to say that curators are trying to shape what I make or change it, but they inevitably give me information so that they contribute to changing my work in different ways. And it's a magical experience. I'm about to embark on a whole new journey, a journey with a curator for an exhibition next year. And I've known this, it's actually director, and I've known director curator. I've known her since 2006 from afar, but now we're physically working together. It turns out she's an artist. I think a lot of these curators wear multiple hats too. And I think sometimes the public doesn't realize that. Also, I don't think artists realize that I think curators come from all different vantage points. I think everybody in the arts wears multiple hats. So they offer different things. But at the end of the day, the relationship is one human being collaborating with another. And it's really special and magical.
without kind of, you know, this is where we can give a little dirt, but we maybe don't have to do names or institutions even. But I wonder, we talked about those amazing experiences early on in your life. Does anything ever stick out as a horrible museum experience you've ever had or a show or something? I mean, if you don't want to kind of get into the specifics, that's fine. But this is called Museum Confidential after all. But something that you just walked into it and it made you physically angry, or you just thought like, this is the biggest waste of my time. Do you feel critical going into a show? Are you able to see a show without the eyes of a critic?
You know, it's hard. It's hard, I have to say, because I think one thing I've discovered is you become more sort of high profile. It's almost like you're not allowed to take off that hat, you know, and I think that's a problem. It's like you feel like even when you go to something just for the sake of going, people will always see you in a certain way, right? And so they're going to judge you or like look at you or frame anything.
Like a restaurant critic going to a restaurant. Yeah.
And, you know, and I think the worst parts of museum culture tend to come from the commercial gallery world. It's when it starts blurring into this kind of, nowadays it's the art fair mentality. And I know a lot of people sort of have this, you know, it's like, oh, it's just sort of this accumulation of things. That can often be, and for a while, it was very impressive to see these sort of almost anthropological kind of like shows where they're mixing objects and stuff. But now it feels sometimes when it's not done well, it feels like an art fair, you know? And it's like, so you're like, okay, who is this serving? Is this just visual stimulation? And is that really what we want to be? You know, just visual stimulation for people. And I think that's scary to me. The other thing is often the things I get angriest at are national museums because they often present very, you know, restrictive narratives of like a country or a people or this. And there's a lot of things that are left out, as you can imagine. You know, I mean, the National Gallery of Art in D.C. has an infamous reputation for not collecting historic African-American artists, do you know, as an example, or female artists that are not contemporary, you know? And it's like, and that can be really troubling because that's where, you know, people are educated. The big issue, I'll tell you, for instance, this year that, you know, really opened my eyes was classical art. Doesn't sound like it should be that controversial. But, you know, we published an article a few months ago talking about the polychromy of classical art, that really all that art originally was color, right? It was painted. And it was in the 18th and 19th century where often they would even take off the color or sand it or something to make it seem more white and pure and all these sort of ideological. And you know what? The person who wrote that article for us started receiving death threats. And even on her university campus, there were groups that were actually protesting her and putting up things that were targeting her. And why is that? Well, guess what? If you went to the Metropolitan Museum in New York, you would not know that most of these sculptures are color. So that tells me museums are not doing their job.
So in a situation like that where you know, you're the editor and you have a writer who has crossed over into some area that's dangerous and different for someone writing art criticism or a piece about art.
It wasn't even art criticism, by the way. It was art historical.
Art historical.
Yeah.
Was that a new thing for you? I mean, how do you deal with something like that? As you know, obviously it's not happening all the time, but
it is,
you know,
actually happening all the time. Yeah, last week an artist told me my photo showed up in an alt-right chat room, and we've had other instances where people were sent death threats, and this stuff does happen all the time, unfortunately.
Do you see it ramping up more?
A little bit, but I will tell you, you eventually learn that there are degrees like of it, meaning like just because you get hate comments, you know, sadly, in this day and age, doesn't mean what it necessarily means. Like, if people are starting to post your personal address, pictures of your children, yeah, all of which have happened to people I know, you know, it's like, that's when you're like, that's a problem. And that's the reality of this sort of networked space now where these discussions are happening. And people, museums traditionally, I think we could say, really did serve an elite ideology of sort of like educating the masses. Kind of, it had a little bit of that kind of one way. Now we're learning that the conversation is two ways, but we're still not sure where that other part is coming from always, you know, and sometimes they don't come from very good places.
Well, I think, you know, that brings up such a fascinating topic, Sharon. I'd kind of interested to see what you think about this, which is the concept of museum neutrality. And we had a situation where during the November election last year, there was a state ballot initiative here in Oklahoma to give the public school teachers a raise across the board. They're quite underpaid, and it's kind of a national tragedy here. I mean, people write about it all the time. Oklahoma is losing teachers all kinds of places. And so there was a ballot initiative to give these teachers a raise. It did not pass. Our director, Scott Stulen, had just started at the museum, and he made a decision to write an open letter, and we published it in the newspaper, and it was him saying, this is not right. This, what happened is not right. We're going to, as an institution, take a stand and do what we can do. We can't do everything. We can't overturn that. But as a museum, what can we do? And we decided to give memberships to the museum, which is about an $80 value to us, to every public school teacher throughout the whole state, if they would like one.
And I think that yielded 1,500 new memberships, if I remember.
So far, yeah, and it's growing. But it's something like that.
Yeah.
Should museums, in you guys' opinion, be stepping into those arenas more often?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think museums have so many different roles now. And I think they're evolving. And part of that evolution is responding to the needs of audiences and understanding that culture and art are lived things, not just static things that one puts behind glass. And I think that's partly just this sort of new rage of contemporary art and museums sort of catching up to sort of tell these different kinds of stories. The diversity of contemporary art tells us that there are different types of stories being told. And that includes teachers, and that includes them being a foundational element of cultural production. Not even like nice to have. Like if you don't have good teachers, guess what? The reality is so much of culture is going to be restricted from you because you're not going to have the skills to understand it. You're not going to have the skills to research it, all these types of things. And so I think that's fantastic. I think what a great model for other places to say, like, elementary school teachers are our community. They are the people that really educate our future audiences.
And I think Scott's opinion was, you know, let's do what we can do. And we didn't know what the reaction would be. It's been 95% very positive.
Yeah. I feel like we're in a little battle in general, and I think we're changing minds one person at a time. And I think if you think of it that way, that's really powerful, as opposed to, like, we're not trying to do this mass
thing. We're turning the ocean liner.
Yeah, we're not turning ocean liners. We're turning individuals. Yeah. And you know what? The ripple effects of that kind of activity are really important in our culture. You know, one person can actually make a difference. And I know that sounds idealistic, but I actually truly believe it because we have examples of where that has happened.
Do you think it's taken longer? You see some things like galleries, private galleries, doing more provocative things. Obviously, there's a different ownership. They don't have, a lot of times they don't have a giant board of directors that they have to answer to, or they're not a 501c3 organization that has certain restrictions for tax purposes. It's taken a long time, it seems like, for museums to kind of get on board with the social justice element of what we're doing. And we actually created a vision statement. So we have a mission statement, which we've had forever, but we recently created a vision statement, and it does talk about us having a role in social justice. Why do you think that's taken so long?
I think museums, if they stay silent, I think that they're just participating in regression. I mean, I really believe that every museum has a responsibility to their public, and they need to go out into the public. I think one thing that Scott's doing is trying to engage the public by actually physically, you were talking about, Harag, one person making a difference, so that Scott, by physically going out into these neighborhoods, by having a presence, but somehow museums carrying their programming into outside of the museum so everybody doesn't have to go into the museum all the time to be able to participate, I think is extremely necessary right now. But why has it taken so long? I think that because museums are usually wealthy institutions that are supported by a board of trustees that are completely controlling of that situation. And there's a lot of isolation there.
So you think it comes down to an issue of class in a certain sense?
I think it does.
It often does. And I think even, unfortunately, public museums, still it comes down to an issue of class. I mean, how many truly public museums are there, you know, that don't rely on private funds, even national museums, you know?
Or have an endowment where they're not having to go out and fundraise.
Exactly.
Similar to politicians.
You
know,
we
see politicians, and what stance would they take differently if they didn't have to go raise money or be up for re-election? It's the same kind of problem in a certain kind of sense.
Or even, you know, have works donated. Like not, you know, most works, or at least quote-unquote blue chip works, are out of the budgets of most museums nowadays. You know, I mean, how many museums can buy a work for $10 million, probably three in the country, you know, Getty, Metropolitan,
or you see these,
like,
you know,
one other. You
well,
know?
There was just this Leonardo da Vinci piece.
Yes.
They went up for $100 million or whatever it was.
That's right. It's like, so that definitely plays a role in the way people are going to perceive it, because it's actually cultivated. It's not, you know, there's a reason why so many of them are named after really wealthy, the Frick Museum. You know, there's a very clear, and also just their geographies. You know, in New York, they're on the Upper East Side, or they're in Manhattan, which now has become, or at least Lower Manhattan, which has become very wealthy. You know, and there's a reason the real estate where you are. I mean, I was just in Bogota, Colombia. And of course, I was like, is this the poor part of the town? They're like, no, it's the museum area. You know, and you're like, of course, that's where they're going to be, in the wealthy parts of town. Right. So already their geography sets them apart and creates a class consciousness. For instance, when I was in the UAE a few years ago, and I was sort of talking to the workers, and I was interviewing workers who were actually building the museum. So I was like, do you want to visit that museum one day? Every single one of them said, I don't think I'd be welcome. You know, and then I was like, well, what if you were? They were like, well, I couldn't afford it anyway. These are the people building this museum, and they don't feel like it's for them. And I think that's not uncommon. I think that's actually increasingly common. People feel like this is not a safe space for me. We don't get rid of all the trappings of our culture when we walk through the door of a museum, like right. It's somehow a freeing space. If it feels freeing for you, that's great. But that means probably then it suits all the cultural things that make you who you are, right? But it doesn't necessarily mean everyone feels the same way.
Right.
I think that until the boards change, that they're become more inclusive, also that there are artists on the boards of museums, and they become more diverse and reflective of their communities, they're going to stay isolated. I also think that museums have to have far more community engagement than they're having across the country. I mean, I think that's increased in the last 10 years. And I just think the programming that Scott is trying to push forward is contemporary. It can be a really good example for other museums.
This episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by strips of black tape on the floor. Nothing says stay back, and this thing's important like a thin strip of black tape in front of a work of art. Less of a trip hazard than wire and far more affordable than lasers, this simple application does the job every time. Let's hear it for black tape on the floor, working hard to make sure museum guests never cross the line.
There's probably a generational component here as well. I think, you know, when you see the millennials are running the museums, there will be some difference. When the board of a museum is full of millennials, you know, it will be a different world.
You know? I don't know. I mean, I guess you mean when they get older.
Yeah, 30, that's 40 right, years right, from right. now. I mean, right. time changes everything, right. of course, but it's hard to imagine that won't have some pretty major impact.
But I'll give you an example. Like one of our staff writers, Allison Myers from Oklahoma.
Yes.
And I know that it's because she was going to museums here that she really cultivated an appreciation. And I see, I mean, her mind is brilliant, you know, and she sees, but it's because museums helped sort of see the world. And I think that's often in the best case scenario. Mm-hmm. It helps us see the world beyond the limitations of our current geography and current world and life. And sometimes now, I think increasingly, museums are starting to become laboratories for new potential things that can then morph and develop into other things. Like sometimes little workshops and experiments and maybe performances and things that then go on and have lives outside of the walls of the museum.
And being prepared to fail, you know, I think experimenting with the thought that this might not work, you know, mm-hmm. and it's okay if this bombs, but at least we're pushing the boundaries. I'd like to kind of jump back into art for a second. It seems to me that what a museum was 50 years ago was a big place with lots of paintings in it mm-hmm. or sculpture in the garden.
That's right.
And it seems like when you read stories and you're editing and writing pieces about this all the time, the things that are really getting the attention now are these spectacles, you know, mm-hmm. or they're site-specific installations, or they are not performance, but just something that causes kind of awe, wonder, something that
Instagram
does
Instagram like, ready.
Yes,
too.
Exactly. Right. And we've had a couple of these at the museum, but I wonder if this constant having to up the ante every time, you know, everybody's kind of do the next big thing, the next major thing. A good example would be, you know, like Kara Walker's piece at the Domino Sugar Factory, which was such a brilliant piece. It was a cultural happening. It was a thing. But there were also, when you look at the film she made about people visiting it and taking, you know, photos with it while she was kind of undercover, there was all kinds of things happening there, which also commented on how people can use a work of art. But I wonder, you know, where do you see museums in terms of, you know, are we going to have to hit some point where we just are competing with the next big thing all the time, and we can't just be a collection anymore?
Well, I think they're becoming a lot of things, but yes, partly. And I don't think that's unusual, though. I mean, I think we can just look at history. I mean, 18th century Paris or 19th century Paris, people were going to salons, right, as social events. And it wasn't always just about the art. It was about being seen. And so I don't think that's, I think that we're just human beings and the social aspect is always going to be there. And sometimes that is the, you know, the gateway drug to like a bigger vision of art and understanding what it is. And that's fine, you know, but it's not the only thing museums are. And when museums start becoming that and try to keep focusing on that, we're going to have issues, because I think then you can't do difficult work, you can't fail, you can't do all these things that museums should be allowed to do. And that does concern me.
I think it's really important, too, that museums do not forget their own community. I think oftentimes museums want to be able to reach outside to have the new big thing, or somebody from New York or an urban area when it's a regional museum. So I think that it's really, really important to not forget local artists and bring them in all the time, even in a conversation or having a context with somebody else from outside the region. So I'd like to see that actually more often, like project spaces that, like MoMA used to have a project space for people who are emerging, quote unquote emerging, or in the, I would call them the 99%, but probably not, I suppose. But they took that away, and now they're not so interested in that. I'd like to see that come back more.
So I want to kind of wrap up with a couple of things. We're going to go a little bit hypothetical here, very hypothetical, which is you're getting sent to Mars, okay? You're going to Mars.
Is that the planet? Yeah. Can we have another planet like
Elon
Saturn?
Elon Musk is sending you to Mars, okay?
Okay.
So that's where we are with this.
Right. All right.
But you're packing your stuff. You've said goodbye to everybody. But he says you have an hour to go to any museum in the world and see anything you want. And you get to pick where. So you have an hour in any museum before you go to Mars. And you're not coming back. Where are you going?
I would probably go to the Art Gallery of Ontario, because I think that was the museum that educated me first in art.
You're going back to the beginning.
Because I think at the end of the day, often it is those things that sparked that interest, right? That really create the sort of those feelings and those memories and the understanding why you love art and what it does for you and how you learn about it.
Anything
and
specifically you'd really want to make sure you see there?
There's probably like 12, 15 objects,
things,
you know,
that,
like
that would spark something.
Yeah. I mean, everything from like the Henry Moore room there, they have a giant gallery of Henry Moore's, to like, you know, they have fantastic Picasso, they have fantastic Gorky, they have a Rothko that's really beautiful, you know, and they have all these different types of things, and they have a really fantastic Rembrandt, you know, it's like all these, and these are the little things that, and I think it's a lot of it is sort of understanding like what sparked that, you know, and sometimes it's something small, so it doesn't have to be the Vatican, you know, but it's for me, it would be there.
I was thinking the same thing. I would go back to the Hirshhorn. It's so funny. I was thinking the same thing.
Kind of bookending your life a little bit here on Earth.
Yeah, but every time I go back to the Hirshhorn, it's really special for me. I don't think there's a lot of occasions to go back to familiar with that same feeling of goodness. And so every time I go back, I have that same feeling. It's like an injection. Even if I don't like some of the work that they have on view, I still get that feeling of a place that gave me something back. Mm. And then also I don't get that a lot. Like in my childhood, I didn't get that. I didn't get a lot of support at all to be an artist, but that museum still gives it to me today. So I would just be there. Yeah, I would live there for sure. I would totally live there. I think I know every crevice of that museum now, and I would be happy there.
Your last hour on Earth at the Hirshhorn.
Right. But I will tell you, I think that's also why now when we see a lot of protests and things around museums, and I think that's why museums should get things right. Because I think when people protest a museum show, I think it's partly, it's people like to think of it, oh no, it's just negative. No, it's because people want to see themselves in the museum. They want to understand themselves in the world. And so sometimes that's really what people are asking for. They're saying, represent my history properly. Mm-hmm. Represent who I am.
So you're saying museums should be a mirror of some sort.
Well, they are. They are a mirror often. Unfortunately, they're often just a mirror of rich people. And I think they should be a much bigger mirror.
Yeah. Well, we had a great time talking to you today. Thanks for coming in, and look forward to maybe chatting again sometime.
Thank you.
This was wonderful.
In 1989, during an episode called Art or Garbage, provocative TV talk show host Morton Downey Jr. physically attacked a guest artist named Mark Kostabi after a publicity stunt gone awry. In the aftermath, Downey sued for assault. Kostabi claimed that a $40,000 painting that appeared on the show hadn't been returned. He countersued. Later that year, Downey claimed that neo-Nazi skinheads attacked him in a bathroom at the San Francisco International Airport. Authorities could never verify the attack, and many believe it too was a stunt. And before his career in television, until 1984, Downey, who also dabbled in doo-wop, hosted a program at KFBK AM in Sacramento, where he pioneered his controversial, abrasive style. Downey was eventually fired, and the job was given to one Rush Limbaugh.
Buzz, buzz. Buzz, buzz. Buzz, buzz. Buzz, buzz.
Watch out. Stand back. Beware.
Watch out. Stand back. Beware.
Well, that's love. Just...
That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.